Thank you. Good afternoon. This will be a non-technical talk, and it'll be short. My interest is in the relationship between this group that we have here and the rest of the scientific community, and the relationship between the scientific community and the greater polity, mainly the United States. I think each country tends to have its own set of problems, and so mine's limited to that. And I'll start at the beginning. The Fleischmann and Pons announcement in Utah, now so many, many years ago. Chase Peterson, then president of the university, set forth the correct methodology of response for the scientific community. Several years of experimental work, he pointed out, would be required to evaluate the claims that were made that afternoon. And this proved a reasonable estimate for the time it actually took to confirm that excess heat was real. After that, Professor Hagelstein would open his talks on LAN theory, LANR theory, or LENR, if you prefer, with the statement, "I believe that excess heat is real." They insisted that the evaluation of the FMP experiment was now complete. Well seared into our memory is the events that took place 5 weeks after the announcement. At the American Physical Society meeting in Baltimore, when two scientists from the California Institute of Technology remonstrated aggressively against the claims. They insisted that the evaluation of the FMP experiment was now complete. Currently available hydrogen fusion theory and data did not allow the possibility of fusion, and bad calorimetry mortally damaged the claim of excess heat. Emphatic use of slander was not beneath them. The Utah chemists were declared to be delusional. One of the Caltech scientists took the trouble to hold several press conferences just to be sure that their charge was well nailed down for public consumption. As might be expected, neither Fleischmann nor Pons nor their associates had the skill or zeal to respond forcefully to such an onslaught of vituperation. Unfortunately, 16 months would pass before publication of a detailed 55-page exposition of the experiment and the calorimetry that went with it, which publication the scientific community met with a resounding silence. Even today, that paper is rarely referenced. I ask that this community, in your research papers, always reference the original experiment, Journal of Electroanalytical Chemistry, for April 10, 1989, May 10, 1989, and July 25, 1990. By the fall of 2003, the scientific community once again displayed its obtuse attitudes towards LANR. The New Hampshire MIT Club asked me to bring my PowerPoint show to one of their monthly meetings. How they picked up the idea to contact me, I don't know. But when I showed up at the, the late Dr. Mort Goulder, one of the club's senior members and an MIT physics alumnus, class of 1946, glommed onto my right arm. He took the chair next to me at dinner and had endless questions to ask. Goulder held a doctorate in physics and had been an officer of Sanders Associates and Raytheon Corporation. He was well known and highly respected within the science community at MIT and in associated industries of the area. In semi-retirement, besides running a consulting service, he was a philanthropic patron of MIT's physics department. After the presentation, Goulder offered a proposal to me. He would undertake a visit to the people at MIT's physics department to see if he could interest them in the evidence for excess heat. I delivered to him several copies of my book and a binder, big 3-inch binder, with 20 or more papers on the most revealing experiments of the previous 14 years. In late September of 2003, I received a letter from Gulder reporting on his visit. He had met with the then head of the physics department and several of his top theoreticians and experimentalists right here at MIT. Gulder was unable to interest them in the subject. In his letter to me, reporting on it, he gave the 5 reasons they expressed for avoiding the topic, and he listed them in according to their order of importance. 1, it is theoretically impossible. 2, the government has spent millions chasing this wild goose to no avail. 3, those who report positive results have little credibility in the scientific community. 4, the only constructive comment was that there was some unknown exothermic chemical reaction taking place, but it was not putrid. And 5, they also mentioned, this was in 2003, that no one had run a controlled experiment with H2O instead of D2O. Most revealing was Gulder's closing bid. Before departing the meeting, he offered to contribute funding for the graduate student to try to understand, for a graduate student to try to understand what was going on in the field. There were no takers among the 5 or 6 who were meeting with him. To borrow from one of Robert V. Duncan's favorite expressions, the MIT physics department was letting others do their thinking for them on at least 3 of the 5 reasons they gave for not being interested in the field. This dismissive attitude towards LANR perpetuates from year to year, and it gets alluded to regularly by those newspaper and magazine writers who call themselves science reporters. This field will eventually require a substantial degree of public financing, so public attitudes towards it need nurturing. DOE is the ultimate target. Unfortunately, the science reporter, to a large extent, is an intermediary between the science and the public. It's important to note how the science reporter works. The salaried ones in America whose job title is science reporter are a small group of about 50 to 70 in full-time employment. They do not have a scientific education or the background of experience in the field of science. The question may fairly be asked, how do they manage to make a career of reporting with a high order of accuracy, cold fusion notwithstanding, concerning new developments in various fields of science? Their means are ancient. They ingratiate themselves into the company of leading scientists, especially those who are authors of popular books. When something new comes up, the reporter gets his story from them. He's thereby enabled to express himself with precise statements on complex issues. The scientist, in turn, gets to see his name placed in public publications, national publications, and as a contributor to some profound public topic. In those cases where there's a serious controversy, the reporter has a choice. He can stand by his source and offer his intelligent sentences, or he can treat the matter as a horse race by reporting who is scoring and who is not. Recently, Dr. Mel Miles corresponded with a science reporter who had written the Fleischman obituary for the English weekly journal Nature, arguably the foremost scientific journal. And at this science reporter pointed to the 4 experiments that reportedly failed to generate excess heat in the spring of 1989. In a letter to him, Miles responded to this argument by referring to the lack of adequate loading in their experiments. the now well-established requirement of 85% minimum deuterium loading in palladium. In particular, Miles pointed to the Lewis paper published in Nature that reported on his experiment. It reported a loading of just 78%. That reporter dismissed Miles' point out of hand. He used the argument that Lewis was not now involved in their conversation. Without Lewis present to defend his paper, reference to it was inadequate and unfair. In that reporter's view, the numerical details as reported in the published paper did not serve as a definitive purpose. Without the author actually present to answer Miles' point, there was no compelling argument by way of the published paper. This inability of the science journalists, and I consider it to be widespread, to make use of published research papers is an endemic flaw in current science reporting. In other words, they hire the wrong kind of people. The November 1998 issue of Wired magazine offered an outstanding exception to this pattern. Reporter Charles Platt wrote an article on the status of the field of cold fusion that quite simply reported the published results. This was an unusual and commendable example of competent reporting. Where LANR scientists depend on published papers for their knowledge of the field, those same papers offer no bridge to the mainstream media's science reporters, between us and them. One thing the reporters enjoy is chasing after claims of power production demonstrations. That seems to be a subject they believe they can handle by themselves. A New York Times reporter apparently was been sent to see some of Rossi's ECAT demonstrations in Italy. But that same newspaper has not mentioned the papers of Dr. J.F. Piantelli from the 1990s, reporting the strong production of heat energy from which the ECAT equipment design has evolved. So far, little illumination of our work can be expected from science reporters reporting in mainstream publications. Another topic looms large that will eventually compel attention. A brief glimpse of what the American environmental movement might have in store for LANR may serve as a useful warning, a warning that emphasizes the need for commerce when anticipating the world of commerce. The environmental movement took nuclear fission, electric generation by surprise in the 1970s. Today, the movement is much stronger with enormous public standing and government agency support that would enable it, if it chose, bring in LANR to a standstill for a second 25-year interlude. After dealing with DOE, EPA will follow close on. What argument would the environmental movement use? The argument that it generates radioactivity, not in some distant fortress-like building, a guarded and fenced concrete monument of sorts, but rather in the home, in the vehicle, and in the workplace. That this radioactivity is minute, short-lived, and boxed in, though true, will prove a difficult point to carry. Just note the outcry of possible brain damage from a cell phone. And the movement would do this to what purpose? Its purpose would be to limit the amount of energy which 300 million polluters can further undertake to ruin the environment by using that energy to build larger and more differentiated houses and by almost continuous traveling about by every means available. The environmental movement itself is always somewhat hobbled in this respect. It cannot address itself directly to this matter. After all, it loves these 300 million polluters because they include its sympathizers, its ardent supporters, and its contributors. But the movement so far has found a way to limit our access to energy by law, by high prices, and for some major sources of energy, such as the Alberta tar sands, by revolt. This movement will not be easily disarmed. The field's first successful breakout in America, that's our field, into scientific and professional acceptability is a recent establishment of the Sidney Kimmel Institute for Nuclear Renaissance in the physics and astronomy departments of Missouri University at Columbia. The then Vice Chancellor for Research, Dr. Duncan, achieved this simply by fortifying himself with data demonstrating excess heat and asking to search for the understanding of it. Critics who suggest there might be error in this data are, proverbially, led to the campus laboratory where they can make a major contribution by identifying that error. Using this approach to disinterested parties constitutes a winning strategy. But alas, it requires a campus laboratory. Recall that the government's November 1989 review of this incipient field contained a strong argument about methodology expressed in Professor Norman Ramsey's words. Quote, even a single short but valid cold fusion period would be revolutionary. It's now 10 years since the U.S. Department of Energy Office of Science last accomplished a small review of this field. I think that was 2004. When the time becomes opportune, now it is not, and it is persuaded to a small review of our field again, what would constitute a suitable set of review arrangements? They should be limited to evidence for the production of anomalous heat power and energy. If the reviewers are suitably qualified, they will necessarily have expertise in two things, thermodynamics and calorimetry, the principal skills appropriate to this much narrowed topic. By concentrating reviewer time and specialty on the production of heat, the field would gain new recognition. And of course, this is what happened with the CBS 60 Minutes. If DOE will not agree to these terms, then a small DOE review is probably not worth a repeat of the previous attempt. Only a much larger scale review could be expected to absorb 25 years of our accomplishment. So the recommended question to be answered by a new review asks, has a single valid anomalous heat period occurred? If the review answers in the affirmative, science will have officially gained a new source of energy to be explored for its science and later for its usefulness to society. Thank you.
I would have thought that transmutation evidence is stronger. It doesn't require the calorimetry. You could actually have the person supply the sample and then take it away and reanalyze.
And that's to show the nucleus. How do you narrow it down? This is something you might or might not be able to do.
But I mean, the point is that the sample before and after is irrefutable. There's no process questions.
I know. It's just very hard to settle these things. There will be differences in opinion. Yes.
Now, in the partial answer to your question, the people we work from the Naples, they will give us cathode, the analog of all the transmuted things. A chemist says in Rome that they've come out of the air.
Yeah.
To bring a unit on the market, selling on the market, even if it's just a toy, that would break it.
That's very nice, yes, yes. Getting a, successfully getting a commercial product out even through the, without the EPA putting a lock on it is a very nice way to break out.
Bob Duncan said that he would be the first to buy.
Yes. He did? To buy, if it's lawful to buy. Okay. Yes.
Your review was extremely accurate. I've lived through it. We would all, I think, say that it was very accurate. But you didn't mention the word politics once.
What's politics?
It may be the reason that nothing's happened. And in particular, I would like to point out that the President of the United States has an office called the Office of Science and Technology Policy. And I personally have approached almost every president's staff in that particular office because that's where issues like this are decided for a particular administration. If you can even get an appointment there, you're doing very well, let alone to have a face-to-face discussion with any one of those, no matter who the president is, whether he's Republican or Democrat. Yes. But when the president comes out in his State of the Union speech and says, we're going to look at wind and geothermal and solar, and that's all it's ever mentioned, you get a pretty good message from what their platform is, and I would like what you would say we should do about that.
Oh, I have no magic bullet for getting the government to turn around. If the president told the Energy Department to look, let's look into this seriously, then it will be looked into seriously. But most presidents don't know from beans about what we're doing, and we just turn to their advisor and ask him, and they'd say, the physicists tell us there's nothing there. And that's what it's about.
Well, that's why he has that office. That's what I'm saying. If we can't get to that office, we can't affect what goes on in the president's mind.
That's why I use the word polity instead of polity.
I think we've got
Dr. Moniz came from here. He's the Secretary of Energy right now. Did he know about while he was here? Ernie Moniz.
Oh, I don't know. I understand he won't allow the term to be spoken in his presence.
Okay.
Just wanted to know. That's second hand.
Is that second hand? Make somebody else in the room.
You are only talking about U.S. But the world consists of some other places, like Brussels. In Brussels, they had an official meeting under the auspices of the European Commission in June last year, where they invited people to come and inform them about Lena.
And then, of course, in Japan, you have an island nation with no resources for energy other than having a super tanker arrive twice a day. They take this matter much more seriously. And much more productive in general.
I'd like to add 2 points to this. One is,
yes, Larry.
We have a saving grace here. The fact that the Department of Energy has stated unequivocally that there is no radiation, that there is no effect, means that people can sell devices and the EPA has nothing to complain about.
I understand the patent office has a page out of a Newsweek magazine that says there's nothing there, and they use that to justify turning down.
But there's a second point. I gave a set of lectures in Belgium in 2009, and on the third day that I was there, I went over to their nuclear establishment at their invitation at SCK, and I gave about a 2-hour talk on the work that's been done in the field.
Very good.
And after the talk, I had the two people come up who were retired, who were the previous heads of that establishment at the time of the 1989 announcement.
Yeah.
And they took me aside and said, it's a good thing you didn't give this talk 20 years ago. I said, why? Because we would have been fired.
Sure.
What they had done is they had over 100 people trying to repeat Kahn's inflation. And in the course of repeating it, they saw excess heat. They pulled an engineer in to explain why this was happening. And he walked into the room, looked around, looked at the instrumentation, looked at the ceiling and saw there were overhead lights. He said, it's coupling from the lights. And that was the end of the project.
Well, here at this school, I understand all the papers were they were one of the four people to do these experiments. All the papers have been destroyed. Anyone want to comment on that?
Plasma fusion science?
Wherever the experiment was done here, it was one of the four experiments that did not produce excess heat.
I have good copies of all the lab books.
Oh, yes, but the MIT does not have them.
There are.
Thank you very much.